Let's talk to interesting people. Let's talk about the process of seeing things differently. Let's talk about the craft of molding truth and fiction together to arrive at something new and exciting. And let's have fun while doing it. Welcome to the True Fiction Podcast.
Welcome to the True Fiction Podcast, the place where we dive deep into the minds of incredibly talented and creative individuals and try to unravel the mysteries behind their inspirations. I'm your host, Patrick Boggs, and joining me on this fantastic journey is my co-host of True Fiction, the uncanny Norbert Yates. How's it going tonight, Norbert?
I'm strapped in and I'm ready to go.
Perfect. We got a great guest tonight. Tonight's guest is an award-winning writer and podcaster. True Fiction welcomes Travis Davis to the show. Hey, Travis, how's it going tonight?
Good. How are y'all doing?
Doing really well. So glad that we could talk to you tonight. And you've got a couple very interesting books out. One is called Flames of Deception, and the other one is called Cobalt, The Rise and Fall of the Great Reset. Can you talk a little bit about these books?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Flames of Deception was my first try at writing a book or a novel. This has to do with Russia has known something is going on with their oil industry, not the industry, but what's in the ground. And it finally happens and is caught in satellite imagery, which is identified in the National Geospatial Agency in Washington, D.C. Well, actually, outside of Washington, D.C. It starts a whole chain of events about what's going on, because at the same time, Russia, China, India are moving their forces around the world to different choke points, but there's no reason why. There's nothing for them to make them want to do this. So it comes out in the book why they're doing this. And at the same time, because we relied so much on Chinese technology for the green energy, that China has started to do cyber warfare that is very pinpointed on different places in the United States, and it's undetectable. People start as individuals in the geospatial engine and become a team, and that team becomes Team Texarkana, where I carry it to the next novel called Cobalt, Rise and Fall of the Great Reset. China discovers a rare form of cobalt in the Congo that is in a meteor crater. And this allows them to shrink their technology on batteries, this increases storage, decrease the charge time. So what they're doing, they're militarizing it because they've came up with a paint that they can put on their tanks where it becomes a solar collector. So now they can put these little batteries in their tanks and not have to be worried about refuel at all. They'll go and they went down to two crew. But at the same time, they're in cahoots with the World Energy Revolutionary Group, which are some green energy zealots that originally was make the world more green, but it's just about greed and power. And they get together, but Team Texarkana finds out what's going on, but there's a couple different plots going at the same time that end at the end. And I introduce a new character who is a chef, but she's also a CIA agent. So she has a unique way of taking care of people that need to be terminated. And I'm writing the third book called Behind You, Chef, where she is one of the lead characters in it.
Wow. Really seems to be right on the edge of what's actually going on in the world. So I think that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Where do you get the ideas? Like this cobalt special kind is very interesting to me. Is it something you just make up? Do you see it somewhere? Like, I remember Michael Crichton would talk about how he stopped reading novels. He just read like research papers and that sort of stuff for ideas.
I read a lot of newspapers and everything, but I think the cobalt just came in my head. I go, what if there was actually a meteor that had a form of cobalt that could really revolutionize green energy? And then the World Economic Forum is really the verb, right? The World Energy Revolutionary Group. They're one and the same. And it's all about the Great Reset and how they want to basically run the world with the have and the have nots.
It's really close to how it feels these days.
I know. I have to tell people it's fiction. When I'm talking about the books, they go, is that real? It's fiction, even with Flames of Deception, because I put technology in there that if I did this job, this is what I would want the technology to do. And it takes a tremendous amount of research because you have to make the technology almost believable. It may exist. I have no idea. But if I did the job, this is what I wanted to do.
It's interesting about the solar paint, because a few years ago, I heard Elon Musk talking about shingles for houses that were solar collectors, and that if you had like a neighborhood that had all these shingles on, they could basically power the whole neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I thought, man, that is so cool. And now your book is right there too. It sounds like I could definitely see something like that being real. I think that's very cool.
Yeah. When you think about modern warfare, you got to refuel. World War II, that did in almost Patton, but it definitely did in Hitler, because they had to refuel his tanks. They ran out of fuel. The other thing you have to worry about is the crew. You have to worry about food, and you have to worry about bullets. What I've done is I've taken out the need for fuel, and I've taken out the need for bullets, because now they have an electronic rail gun that is able just to shoot particles out there, but it's so fast because it's AI. Now I have what they call identify, target, and kill, ITK, because everybody's connected in the battlefield, right? And it's all ran through a mesh network where you've got satellite feed, you got a UAV, UCAV feed, you got feed from the other tanks, and allows the tanks to decide who to engage and when to engage. So you're taking a lot of the reasons why armies have failed over the years for logistics.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. That's pretty crazy.
When you're coming up with these ideas, do you come up with, you was talking about like your third book, it was talking about the CIA lady. Do you come up with a premise first, or is a scenario come in your mind, or is there a character what starts the process for saying, this is good enough scenario to go for?
It's a scenario, and I have to, like the third book, I've rewritten the beginning numerous times because I have to make sure that it flows right. So it's really a scenario based, and then I work out the story as I go along, and then I make sure that the characters play a pivotal role in it, and how they mature over time, or how their capabilities increase because of technology that is given them or they have access to.
Do you have an end point in mind when you start out?
Yes. Loosely, I do. I do have one. Right now, I'm writing a historical fiction book. I put the third book on hold. I'm writing a World War I historical fiction. I've already got the ending already written, and I've got the beginning, and I'm working through it now. But a lot of times, like Flames of Inception, I had the ending already preconceived. Change it a little bit. You twerk it over time, but I pretty much had it nailed down what I wanted to do.
So my biggest issue with a lot of storytelling is what I call, whenever you get to that point where they put the plot armor on and they forge a path that sometimes makes sense, and sometimes you go, I'm not sure about that. And particularly movies are really bad about this. And you get to that point where you go, that didn't make any sense at all. And obviously did it in order to move to this next step that they wanted to get to this end point. So if you have a loose endpoint, how do you avoid getting into those, writing yourself into somewhat of a corner and you have to do something silly to get out?
I try not to do that. I haven't had that happen yet. I usually have, if I want to go down this rabbit hole, or I want to take this character this way, I know where they want to end up. Cobalt took me a little longer to write than Flames of Deception because I'm running three teams. And they're all doing things independent. They don't really know that they're connected until the end, but they are. So I try not to run that rabbit hole. And if I did, I'd probably back out and figure out, where did I start this, down this path that probably I shouldn't go down, and just rewrite it.
When you're dealing with a lot of characters, this is something that I find very interesting. It's like, how do you populate your... are there a lot of these characters you just make up? Do you make character profiles of them? Or how is this process of developing a characters on different teams, making them believable people?
Yeah. I build a team, and I want the team to be a diverse team when it comes to skill, capability. Example, Chief Tricana is Tex. And Tex is the leader. He's a more older fella, right? Got some military experience, retired from the Army, got some CIA experience. Then there's Will, who is 26-year-old, got out of the Army, geospatial guy, quick wit, but very smart. But people don't realize how smart he is, how perceptive he is. And then you have Kim, who works with Will, who is, you know, speaks Russian, speaks Chinese, very smart, but very analytical in what she does. And then that's the first three. Then I also introduce a character, Lucy, who's a Chinese soldier in Flames of Deception. I can't tell you what happens to her, but it's pretty interesting what happens. So that's how I do it. And the hard thing about when you have multiple characters or multiple things going on at one time is the synchronization or the timing of when do you put them back into the book, right? I can't not talk about somebody for 7 or 8 chapters and introduce them into the plot somewhere. So that timing and that synchronization of bringing everybody back where they're fresh in your mind when you start reading about them again, or the plot or the story.
On the character part, my final thing is, I don't know if you've heard of Alan Moore, who is a comic book writer. He wrote From Hell that was made into basically a lot of stuff. And he was obsessive compulsive about his characters. And he would talk about, he would come up with intricate histories of these characters for 20 or 30 years. And his book would be a micro slice of these characters.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was thinking, man, that's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. But his characters are very memorable and they have a certain life. And I was just wondering how you thought about your characters in terms of, like, you talked about, like, they're different, they're older, younger, there's capabilities, but do you think about them in terms of where they come from or that sort of stuff?
Oh yeah. So I definitely put a history of, in Flames of Deception especially, I put a history behind everybody, where they come from. And for example, Will and Kim, they're in Russia. And Kim asked Will, we've been working together, I don't know anything about you, really. So he's talking about all that his mother's German, when he speaks German, and she goes, I didn't know you speak German, right? So I add those things about them. Her, I leave a little vague, and there's a reason for that in the book. And then Tex is quirky. He likes to be called Top by ex-military because it's first sergeant. He wears the same suit every day because he doesn't want to take the time and figuring out what he has to wear. And so he's like, where's he from? And so I do add that in there because I want people to relate back to, oh yeah, this is just a normal person that's been put in a predicament that is able to work out some very complex things, but he's just like us. And what I do, there's a bar in Manassas, Virginia. It's a beer garden called Eavesdrop. And I was sitting in there with my son and my wife and some of his friends, and I'm writing the ending of Flames of Deception. And I'm like, this place is so cool. What if it all happens in Northern Virginia? What happens that after a mission, if these folks don't go to Eavesdrop and have a beer? So they're in Eavesdrop every book. They go there and that's where they decompress, right? So I'm hoping people read that book and they'll be sitting at Eavesdrop and there's four people that looks like my characters are like, could that be Team Texarkana? Because they're just normal people having a beer. Will likes to drink beer. Those human, you want to put them a human touch in your characters. Not, they don't have to be sterile.
Speaking of having a human touch, are any of your characters based on people that you know? Even if it's just partly?
Yes, loosely. Yes. Yes, they are.
Now, do those people know that they're characters in your book or no?
Probably, yeah. I probably told them that it's loosely based on you. I think Tex is loosely based on me. You could maybe figure it out if you knew some of the people that I know and hang out with.
I know that you started out with the first book, but I'm wondering, is that where your writing started or is there something else that came first?
Nope, that's it.
You just jumped head and feet right in, right?
I'm a late bloomer. I'm a late bloomer. It must have been an aneurysm or something. I had an idea one day. I called a buddy of mine. I've known him from the Army for 30 years. Ran the premise by him. Says it's a good idea. So I started writing Flames of Deception.
Are you retired military?
I am.
Okay. Thanks for your service, by the way.
Well, thank you.
So that probably helps a little bit in your writing these, right?
Mm, yeah. It's definitely helping in this historical fiction that I'm writing in World War I. So yeah, the military does play a role. A lot of the folks in my book are ex-military. Not necessarily retired, but they have a lot of experience, whether it's in none of them have been SEALs, none of them have been special forces. These are just soldiers that had a job to do, and they were very good at what they did.
You've written two books. You're working on actually two more books. How do you navigate the challenges of balancing your personal life with the demands of writing?
So I try to write in the morning a little bit. Then I'm a bus monitor on a special education bus for the school district here. So I do that for a bit. And then I come back. I got 5 hours or so. I'll do some writing. Everybody's at work. Wife's at work. And then I go back and I may do some writing in the afternoon. I try not to write too much on the weekends. If I do, it's before everybody gets up. And I'll try not to write too much at night because I'm just brain dead by then. But I found out the book that this historical fiction book is coming so easy. So I'm doing probably an average of about 1,400 words a day on that.
Wow.
Yeah. I haven't told anybody the title yet, but it's very, the people I've talked to about it are like, okay, I've got to read this because it is so amazing what you're putting together.
Wow. So, I'm definitely interested.
When you're writing, I'm all interested in the process of how people write. I'm thinking about it like, how do you do it? Do you sit down with a legal pad? Do you add a word processor? Do you record it? And how do you keep ideas that if you're on your bus and something hits you, how do you keep that from going into the ether and disappearing?
Yeah, so I don't outline per se. I did a little bit for this book I'm writing because it's time linear. But I do type. I have a little MacBook Pro that I bring with me and I'll peck at it. Or I'll jot something down on a 3x5 card. And that kind of keeps me ground, what I thought or how I thought. I write, and I love listening to country and Western music when I write. I can listen to music and write at the same time. I don't have to be in a sterile environment. It helps my creativity, but I do like that. When I sit down, sometimes I just sit down and I can just hammer it out. And then sometimes, not in this book that I'm writing now, but in the third book I'm writing with Team Texarkana, I was like, okay, I'm struggling a little bit. I need to back up. And how do I want to take this where I want to take this? But from a writing standpoint, don't outline and just go for broke.
You're writing a historical fiction. And it has to do with something going on in World War I. Is that correct?
Yes.
Are there any other genres that you've thought about handling or any ideas pop up in any other genres?
I actually have a kid's book that I want to write. I've got the whole story in my head, everything, but I got to figure out how to write a kid's book. It's different.
It's not a kid's book about a CIA operative, is it?
It is not. It's not. It's about a mouse.
A mouse. Wow. Nice.
Yeah. So I've got it all. I can see it. I can storyboard it in my head already. I'm gonna get done with this historical fiction, get on that. When I'm done with that, I'm going to get back on the third one of Team Texarkana. So I'm doing the research for this historical fiction, and I've got tons of stuff. My wife's, okay, you need to quit buying books. Go to the library. So tons of stuff I'm reading, internet, book, newspapers, everything. And I found this, just one sentence in this book that I'm reading about World War I, I'm going, that's my next book. And I'm starting to work out. It's going to be probably not too much historical fiction, but a kind of a thriller suspense that takes place in 1919.
Oh, wow. That sounds good.
Because I didn't know it. I read this. I go, I didn't know that. And then I called a buddy of mine, that guy that I ran the premise by, the first book. He goes, oh, yeah, that's my dad was there. Not his great or great grandfather was there in World War I. I'm like, well, that's amazing because I'm going to write a book about it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Will you pick his brain or is...
I think I'm going to pick his brain a little bit. He's a military historian anyways, mainly Civil War era and World War II and stuff. But yeah, he's a great sounding board for... He's a very good friend of mine. My old platoon leader in the Army, as a matter of fact.
Oh, wow. That's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't get much closer than a military friend, I don't think.
Yeah. No, I agree. Even though you don't see each other for years, when you do see each other, it's like you just saw yesterday. You're right back up.
Yeah, that's an interesting phenomenon. I don't know if, I'm sure there are other groups that have that, but I know that military is famous for that.
Yes, exactly.
Do you ever have any days that you need to write, but you don't know if you want to? What inspires you to write, to keep writing?
I'll set a deadline of when I want the book done. Then I figure out how many words I have to do a day. I'll say, okay, I need to get them done by then. If I make it, I'm not under any hard deadlines other than my own. And I'll try to work towards that. Some days, okay, that if I don't write, I'm researching. Because what I found out that's very unique about writing is when you write, you learn. No matter what, because I've learned stuff all the time. Even when I do the Team Texarkana series, the stuff I want to find out about artificial intelligence or facial recognition or satellite imagery or anything like that. And in this one, I'm reading about World War One and the gas attacks and different kind of gas and mustard and make it where very believable in the book. So yeah, I'd say when you write, you learn. So write.
Yeah. World War One was so brutal.
Yes.
Is that in part of your book or no?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It is. Yes, it is definitely. And it's remarkable because when you start doing your research for World War One example, there's all these folks in the book. There's Patton, there's Marshall, there's Churchill, there's Hitler, Goering. There's all these people in the book that are the same people in World War Two. Right? Roosevelt,
right.
Truman. So they're all the same people. And it's almost, man, we need to do not a family tree, but a lineage of these folks. Roosevelt becomes president. Truman becomes president. Eisenhower becomes president. Goering, Hitler, all these folks. And the world we live in today was very much shaped by World War One, the outcome of World War One, because of the division of Africa and the Middle East and all these countries from colonialism, and we're filled with repercussions of that, because some of these countries should never become countries. They were just artificial boundaries that, Great Britain or France or whoever put around them. Yugoslavia is a great example of that.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
I know I've heard a lot of people talk about how many, what do you call it, empires died not long after the World War
One.
Some of them were just their leadership class had just become so, in some cases, inbred, but diluted and removed that they didn't think that they would ever lose power. And then the Turkish Empire,
Ottoman
and
Empire.
All these,
Austrian Empire,
they're gone within 10-20 years, and the world just completely changes. And I wonder, when you're writing historical fiction, do you think about that kind of stuff, or do you just try to focus in on your piece of your story?
I think during the research, I do think come across it. So you think about it, and then how maybe am I going to add a little something in the book from. But someone's going to read and go, oh, okay, I didn't know that, or something like that. I don't have to put it in there unless it's part of the story, but I may want to put a little bit of information of, for example, putting on the gas mask and clearing it and all the steps to doing that, or what happened. Why did World War II occur? Because World War I ended in the Treaty of Versailles, and Hitler thought that the German people got screwed, and he went into Sudetenland, went into all these other places, and that's caused World War II. Because what happened in World War One?
Yeah, World War Two was actually World War One Part Two. So
yeah, yep, exactly. Yep, same players. Just can't get away from them.
When you're writing a book, and now you're on your third or fourth book, depending on how you want to count it, I always think that writing a book is a huge accomplishment because it's a force of will. At some point, it doesn't matter if it's a short book, long book. It is an accomplishment if you get it done. Even if you don't get it done well, it's still an accomplishment.
Right.
I wonder, as somebody has been in the military, do you rank it as a high accomplishment in your life or not so much?
I look at it, and I've been told I have reinvented myself more times than people can think of. I think it's a good accomplishment from definitely from my civilian time. When I got out of the Army, I got into technology and I started doing, I used to edit Q Publishing. I used to edit all their MCSE Microsoft books back in the day. So I thought that was pretty cool, right? My name was on technical editor for a lot of books, and I helped write a little security handbook a long time ago, 2001 security handbook. But yeah, I rank it as something cool. I think I rank it as cool. It's a good accomplishment, but it's, you say, hey, I wrote a book. People are like, oh yeah, sure you did. Here it is. Here's what happened though. If I didn't tell somebody or tell people I was going to write a book called Flames of Deception, I probably would never have wrote it, but I told them and I had to finish it. And I did. Then I got interested in, I want to write another one. And now I want to write another one. And it's just, I guess just a part of my journey.
So have you experienced meeting a fan?
Funny. Walking down the street with my wife and we're going to do our morning walk and everything. And we're walking this way and the lady's walking this way with her dog. And she stops and she says, aren't you that writer? And I go, yeah. She goes, oh, I saw your thing for the library here in town and everything. I go, oh, thank you. My wife said, your feet aren't even touching the ground, are they? I go, nope. So now I have to tell her, hey, if somebody says something, just go, it's okay. But yeah, well, I met through that, or I do a lot of book signings and get their feedback. But I enjoy that. You want to make a book enjoyable. That's what you want. They're spending their money. They wanted a good story, and they want a respite from whatever's going on in their world for 15, 20 minutes, however long they're going to read it or listen to it or whatever they want to do.
The type of books that you write, and I think the realism is there. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if anybody's ever questioned you on getting deeper into subjects that you may not be that deep in. I didn't know if that ever happened.
Yeah, somebody would say, how do you know that? And they go, does the military, time in the military have anything to do with it? How do you know all that? I do a lot of research and we started talking about small form nuclear reactors. I don't know much about it, but I have enough to know that when I start talking about it, if somebody asks me a question, if they don't know more than me, they won't ask me anymore.
Yeah. When you're starting to talk about things like that, people usually start worrying a little bit. Yeah.
They're like, how do you know this satellite stuff and oil in Russia? Because it's so believable that around the story, yeah, it could happen. You know, things, stranger things have happened. It Flames of Deception is the largest, the deception goes years back, and somebody finally had to confront it, and it starts a whole chain reaction that they already planned out 25 years ago and had been refining their plans when this happens.
That's easy to believe. I don't want to get off on a tangent, but I think of all the conspiracy theories through the years that have turned out not to be theories,
right?
But in fact, so.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I agree. 100%. So,
one thing that I think about a lot when I think about what I do with a lot of illustration and stuff, you start out at some point and you look back at what you've done 10 years ago or whatever, and you go, oh my gosh, that was terrible or whatever. When you start out doing something new, especially if you're younger, you don't have a whole lot of confidence. I was wondering, when you come into writing later, number one, was you confident in your writing? Did you feel confident in your storytelling? And did the end result match what you thought was going to happen in your head, or did it not match when you got done with it?
I was very confident in the storytelling and the story itself. My writing ability, probably not as confident, but you got editors, which is great. So yeah, but at the end, if I look back, my Flame Deception has been out a year and a half, not very long. If I look back, would I do some things different? Yeah, probably. But I'm very happy with the results of the book. Yeah, I didn't say, every author does. I'm going to write a book and it's going to be another Hunt for Red October. not necessarily the case. It's good to dream, but it's good to live in reality.
And that's not a bad thing to aspire to, though. That's
yes.
A,
oh, heck no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Heck yeah.
Hey, I wanted to talk about your podcast a little bit. Author Sure. Eke?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I got done with Flames of Deception, and I'm like, okay, I don't know diddly squat about book publishing or anything at all about that, about this business. It is a business. What's a better way than to interview authors, established, new, right? Wrote one book or whatever. And so I created Author Eke, which is a German corner for in German, author corner, basically. And I've got 47 episodes done. And I just, much like you, it's just free form. Oh, that sounds good. Let's talk about that, right? And I don't review books because, hey, who cares what I say about a book? But I just want to know marketing. How do they write? When do they write? What they do, and if it's something I like, what interests, I'll start talking about it because I want to learn more about it, and maybe somebody else does. So yeah, so I put one out once a week, and I've got, I think, 11 lined up already that I've got to put out. So they're queued up, and again, I've talked to folks that maybe sold 5 books, to people that have sold millions of books. And here's what I found out. They're all nice people. It's just great.
Yeah.
This is very good.
We love talking to authors. We love talking to anybody, but authors have a special place for us. I think that because we worked on a project together that he was the artist and I was the writer. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, Norbert has a movie. I don't think it's out anywhere. I don't think we put it out anywhere, but it reminded me a little bit of some of the stuff that you were talking about. It's about a satellite that's doing certain specific things, Price of Discovery. It's a very interesting. Interesting, yeah, story. It's less about all the militaries involved, but what if a single person caught something like that and then somebody offered them money for it, for the video? Yeah. I thought it was interesting when you were saying this. I'm like, wow, there's a little bit of a seed here that Norbert had handled. It was pretty cool. I've just looked at a couple of the authors and they write military fiction. But you talk to all kinds of authors, don't you, right?
All kinds. Yes. Yes. The better.
I think one of the things that I wonder, and I was going to ask your thoughts on this, creative people do great creative stuff, but sometimes those creative people don't want to do the business end. Mm-hmm. And the business end is so important. I'm wondering, do you think there's some people out there that are tremendous writers, but we'll never hear about them because they don't do the business?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm a firm believer in that. Even some of the folks that I've talked to. And I did. And I was very naive, probably still am. I'm doing it different. Like this historical fiction, I'm already putting teasers out there. And I haven't even gave the title out yet. People know I'm writing it. Because you have to look at every book like a business, and you have to write a business plan for that book. Okay. Marketing it. What are the phases of the marketing, the pre-launch, the launch, the after the launch? What are you going to do in that? How are you going to get your name out? Where are you going to interview at, right? Where does it make sense to do all this stuff? You have to look at it like that because it has to be a business. And each one is different because you're probably talking to maybe a different, where my thriller, the suspense readers are different than maybe my historical fiction.
Sure.
Maybe completely different demographics. So how am I going to start targeting them? So I think it's very key to look at it. If you look at a pie, take a pie in thirds, writing the book is a piece of the pie, probably not as big as the other two thirds. And then you've got the editing, which is that's probably almost time to write the darn thing. And then you got the marketing, right? And sometimes authors are doing all three again while they're doing the one. It's you're writing a book, but you're also doing marketing another book. But you have to look at it. And I was told, take an hour a day to market your book. That's easy to do. A couple Twitter things or a couple Facebook posts or Instagram or TikTok, right? So you have to look at it as a business. And then as any plan, your plan almost has to be on an Etch-a-Sketch. Because at any time, you need to go ahead and say, psh, that's not working. Let's do something else. And I think that's key. You have to be able to evaluate your plan, reevaluate your plan, tweak it, move on.
It's a lot for, because there's a lot of people that write. And a lot of these people that write, it's not their only gig. And so they're depending on some people and just the time to write. When you're saying that you sat down and type 1,400 words a session, that's mind-blowing. That's a lot, but that is very dedicated, and you're staying on the mark, which is awesome.
Get in a groove. I've probably met, out of all the authors that I've talked to, maybe two, maybe, that don't work.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They all were. So, a lot of Jack Stewart, right? He's an airline pilot. He flies Southwest.
Wow.
A lot of folks work. Some policemen or work for the military or, oh, yeah, a lot of them do. And a lot of them take that time to be able to write. They have a story, they cultivated it, and they want to be able to get it out. I think there's a lot of ways to be able to do that.
I think a lot of art is a labor of love, and people would do it if they didn't make any money. I also think that there's no reason why you shouldn't make money if you can, but it's a labor of love, and it's something that most people can't shut off anyway. So
yeah, I'm always looking for something to do. I've started a couple businesses. I've created some apps for the App Exchange, Apple. I've done a lot of things because I always want to keep your mind active, right? You got a body active, mind active, and then it'll all play out.
Yeah, absolutely. Travis, I think we've run out of time, but it's been a blast talking tonight.
Thanks for having me on. This is great.
Yeah, love talking to you about the books and wish you nothing but the best of luck. I say luck, but I think that you have a plan. So <Yeah. laughs> I think you're going to work your plan and do pretty darn good.
So did Napoleon.
Hey, it worked until it didn't.
It worked until it got cold.
That's right. I really appreciate coming on. It's been a blast talking to you, and maybe we'll talk down the road.
I hope so.
It was awesome. So you have a great night, all right?
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, guys.
Bye-bye. See ya. Bye.
Thanks for hanging out with us on the True Fiction Podcast. If you like what you've heard, please visit us at Facebook. You can also leave us a review on iTunes or through your favorite podcast app. Until next time, stay true and stay creative. Hey, you're too late.